Welcome back. I'm guest host Lester Spence, the good doctor, filling in for Mark Steiner on The Mark Steiner Show, here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You can join us with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or tweet me at Lester Spence and email us at talk@steinershow.org. We're joined by Joshua Holland until about 10:30 by phone. He's a contributor to The Nation and a writing fellow at The Nation Institute. You can follow him at Twitter at Joshua H-O-L. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. And we're having Todd Stephen Burrows, who used to be a Baltimore resident, but unfortunately, as is in Newark. Todd Burrows is an independent researcher and writer. He's the author of Sunshine on Cracked Sidewalks, an audiobook on Amiri Baraka. He's also the author of Roz Baraka, Through the Eyes of the 2014 Newark Mayoral Campaign. He's the co-editor, along with Morgan State's own Jared Ball, of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manning Marable's Malcolm X, and the co-author with Herb Boyd of Civil Rights Yesterday and Today. Finally, he's a contributor to The Root. Todd, what's up?
How's it going?
I'm cold chilling, man. I wish you were actually here.
Man, well, Baraka City's got its things going on, man. But I wish Maryland well.
I hear you. Before I start our media roundtable, I just want to briefly detail a conversation I had with a colleague of mine about 2-3 weeks ago. And I forgot, you know, we were talking about a range of things involving Baltimore, and then everything turned to Trump. And she heard from like a secondhand source that Donald Trump, his play actually wasn't for the presidency, that he kind of had a sense, him and his people had a sense that he wasn't going to win the presidency. His play was rather for the creation of another media entity to rival or replace Fox News. So
I heard that rumor on one of the networks, maybe MSNBC. I heard that.
Yeah,
that's going around.
That's going around, right? So the conversation about the alt-right kind of fits in with that, right? And particularly given what's happening with Fox News under allegations that is basically rife with sexual harassment. So before I want to talk about kind of what the, you know, if that play is accurate, you know, what it might look like, what are the consequences. But before that, I have a simple question for our listeners that our listeners would be interested in. Who or what is the alt-right? Joshua, you could start for me.
The alt-right. The alt-right is it started out of Gamergate, which was this kind of white male backlash against women getting into video games. And it is it's the ugliest faction of the right, I would say. It's it's the nakedly white supremacist white. So, right. So it's hard to kind of put it in a discrete box. It's very much an online persona. It is something that's been embraced by Breitbart. That Breitbart has been the center of the alt-right movement, of mainstreaming the alt-right movement. And they think that traditional conservatives are, they call them cuckservatives, and they think that they're sellouts. They worry about things like quote-unquote white genocide. They're a scary movement. And I would say that if you wanted to look at a parallel, you would look at the far-right white ethno-nationalist European movement. So look at Le Pen in France, UKIP in the UK. These would all kind of be parallels to the American alt-right.
Todd, do you want to jump in?
I think he's hit the nail on the head. The only thing I'd like to add briefly is that the media development, this right-wing media development, as you know, both of you know, I mean, this goes back for decades, ever since Vietnam and civil rights and Roe versus Wade, you know, the right wing has tried to develop a counterculture, right? And the extraordinary achievement of Fox News and now this maybe new digital thing that Trump might be cooking up really shows that these arguments have been circulating for decades, and that Trump and the alt-right is just a natural extension of wanting more from their own establishment. So it's all very fascinating because white nationalism, you know, I mean, Pat Buchanan was saying this stuff like 20 years ago. I mean, the same type of stuff that Trump was saying. All of this, frankly, makes me really miss John McLaughlin, ironically, and the McLaughlin group.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, it's wild, right? Because, I mean, this is where these thoughts were articulated so well and for popular consumption where you could at least understand them. So that's why I understood Trump so easily, because I'd heard Pat Buchanan on the McLaughlin group, you know, saying similar things for like 10, 15 years.
So to the extent, and maybe this is, maybe I'm phrasing this question poorly, but how, quote unquote, big is the alt-right?
Well, I mean, you know, I think Dr. Burroughs is right that this has been something that's been with us forever. And I think that what we're seeing right now is kind of its dying last gasp. I shouldn't get too far ahead of myself, but I think it represents a relatively small slice of the conservative movement, but they have an outsized voice right now, thanks in part to Donald Trump. Donald Trump didn't create this. He's given voice to it. One person I know said, well, he makes subtext into text. No longer are they using dog whistles with Trump. They don't feel the need to be ashamed of their ideology. They're very out and loud and proud right now. But I think that it's easy to confuse that very loud voice, especially on the internet, with large numbers. And I don't think that they have the numbers. And you see, you know, really a huge division in the conservative movement. A lot of conservatives hate these people.
Yeah, I just remember I knew that we were in a new place when George Will was like, I refuse to vote for Donald Trump. And then I've seen a couple of other prominent conservatives who are like, no, we don't, you know, we're not going to support this at all. We can't, we are not going to go in this direction, which is actually kind of odd to me, right? So you take a guy like George Will. George Will was a speechwriter, was a prominent figure in Ronald Reagan's campaign, and Ronald Reagan started his campaign in Mississippi, you know, in an area of Mississippi, in an area right outside of Philadelphia, Mississippi, and it's only his historical importance was that it was the site of the murder of a few civil rights workers. So
if we could put the current moment in maybe some historical context using the left, I just heard Jeffrey Toobin on C-SPAN in their in-depth segment because he has his new book out on Patty Hearst.
Yeah.
And he talked about how, you know, we kind of like put this kind of like sheen on the 70s where we have forgotten that the 70s was a period of very radical social movements that were committed to violence. I think Toobin talked about that there was like one political bombing, but then something like 40 political bombings like a year or something like that.
Yeah.
When he was talking about Liberation Army, and then, of course, we can talk about the Black Liberation Army. When I look at these alt-right folks, you know, those liberation movements in the 70s, the Weathermen, et cetera, those were dying movements because of the end of the Vietnam War, the end of the draft, and those radical movements were kind of like the last gasp of the radicals before everything became very mainstream. What I see on the right is, you know, a dying white movement. The alt-right is a dying white movement that is trying to do the radical edge or the radical end of a dying white movement, meaning that white people, quiet as is kept, are not increasing their population, and they know they're dying out. And this alt-white movement is a reaction to the fact that the Republican Party, these elites in Washington, D.C., in New York, people like Irvin Kristol and people like George Will and even the ethnicities of those people, that they're not relating. And so, you know, people used to ask, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? Well, I think Kansas has woken up, and this alt right-wing movement is kind of like the last embers of white nationalism, which to me makes it quite fascinating.
So, well, one quick question, because that Ty, your comments bring another question to mind. But no, one quick question: What are the Trump's ties to the alt-right? Are they explicit or are they more implicit? Josh,
well, I think our Nation writer has more of the details on that than me.
Yeah.
But it's very clear that Donald Trump publicly began.
Hold on a second, Ty. Josh, I apologize. Josh, why don't you go take that?
It's a little hard to put your finger on because he has kind of distanced himself to a degree. But we know that right now Trump's campaign is inextricably tied to it because he has just made the editor-in-chief of the CEO of Breitbart into the top dog in his campaign. So whereas a month ago that would have been a difficult question to answer, we can say now for sure that he has fully embraced the alt-right movement because Breitbart is the epitome of the alt-right movement. And, you know, earlier on, we have to remember that this was the first candidate who, in recent times, since George Wallace probably, who had Klans groups actually putting together PACs, political action committees, and sponsoring robocalls for him in primary states. So he has flirted with this group previously, and he made it official when Steve Bannon took over his campaign. I think that was the end of his kind of plausible deniability.
So, Todd, the follow-up question I had for you, if this one way to read this is as the last gasp of the white nationalist conservative movement, why is this important? Or are there what are the stakes? Is it purely that there are stakes for them, that this is their last best hope, or are there actually stakes for the rest of us that we should be concerned about?
I think this is extremely important because white nationalism, as you know, you and I know, our ancestor Ron Walters wrote about, is an extraordinarily important movement that goes right up to the edge and perhaps crosses over into overt and covert white supremacy and racism. The fact that white people are aggrieved is very significant because white people still control the levers of power in the society. Now, this schism that now has been opened up publicly by the Trump campaign, where, you know, you see people like David Brooks having to reassess and having to leave the office and go talk to real white people in the country.
Right.
You see there's a reassessment. And the reassessment
he can't find him in the New York Times.
No, I mean, by the way, he admitted this. He said, I didn't see the Trump movement coming. I have to go out and interview real people. And he's done that. Like, he was on Charlie Rose bragging about how he had done that, man, right? So he's getting this whole kind of insight into Garrison Keillor's America now, right? So I think it's extremely important because white people still control the levers of power of this country, both economically, politically, and socially. And this schism, like I don't know how this schism is going to affect the white right wing intellectual class. Will they become populist? If they become populist, then we're talking about a very genteel, you know, race war. I mean, white people riot at the polls. White people riot when, by taking away scholarships, you know, by defunding things. You know, I remember when...
real quick, I'm from Detroit. Now, I remember when the Tigers won the World Series in 1984.
I was going to say college football.
I went to Michigan. I remember when we won the national championship.
Right. So see, white people riot in very specific ways. Like, you know, when the O.J. Verdict happened, and, you know, O.J. is now, of course, back in the news with this incredible documentary and docudrama miniseries. I remember how, and you probably remember this too, both of you, I remember how, like, late-night TV, Jay Leno, those folks, could not let that go for, like, a year and a half. For, like, a year, and at least a year, they talked about the O.J. verdict. And I know Rosie O'Donnell talked about it. So, I mean, white people have very interesting ways of rioting that do impact on communities of color. So I think we have to be very clear about watching them and monitoring them and trying to counteract them.
Joshua, what are your thoughts?
I would distinguish between white socioeconomic and political dominance. I mean, the basic hierarchical structure is not threatened, right? They're threatened by a specific development, I think, which is the rise of the so-called Obama electorate, right? The Democrats used to have to chase white working class people. They fetishized them. At this point, they've put together a coalition to win, at least at the national level, to win presidencies. That's made up of people of color, younger people, urban white liberals. This coalition, right, is a new development. And you see this really clear distinction between midterms and general elections. In the 2014 midterm, Republicans swept because the electorate was 75% white. Now we're looking at an election that it looks like the Democrats are going to win again. It's going to be their fifth in six popular votes. And the electorate is supposed to be 69% white. So this is a huge shift where you have this ability to win elections. I don't think that white people's actual dominance of our institutions is really at risk. Although I do believe that if you asked an alt-right person, they would believe that.
Exactly.
So I would just distinguish between, like, the reality here.
Yeah.
You know, white people are not endangered in any way, and the perception, right? They do perceive that they are losing influence, losing their position at the top of the heap, and it's not really true.
Yeah, I'm going to go to a call in a second, but I was having a discussion on Facebook. Halle Berry has a new movie coming out about a kidnapped kid. There are only 100 kidnapped kids per year. But, you know, from the way we as parents, and I've been guilty of this myself, the way we've been protecting them, you think there were a million, right? It's not quite the same thing, but there is this fear to go back to Public Enemy. There's this fear of a black planet that, in the United States context at least, doesn't necessarily appear to be borne out by data. What I want to do is take, we've got at least one caller on the line. Marie from Baltimore, you're on WEA.
Hello, let me turn down your radio. Hold on, please.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
I'm back. Thank you. Listen, I heard this morning that Donald Trump gave over $100,000 to the Clinton Foundation. Does that make sense?
Oh, that's actually a great question. Joshua, what are your thoughts on that? I hadn't heard this. Had you heard this?
I haven't heard that he had donated to the Clinton Foundation. I do know that he had donated to Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign.
Yeah.
And I think that is, I actually think that kind of comes down to New York politics and the fact that if you're a real estate developer, you're going to want to butter everybody's bread who has political clout over, you know, the kind of construction projects you might have. This was years ago. Let's remember that Donald Trump is on record in interviews as recently as, like, I think 2009, praising Hillary Clinton and saying what a great president she would be. So this is – Donald Trump has been a Democrat. Donald Trump has been an independent. Donald Trump has been fiercely pro-choice. Donald Trump has been for universal single-payer health care like Bernie Sanders. And now Donald Trump is a hardcore right-winger because he is the GOP nominee, because he wanted to become the GOP nominee. And that's just the nature of Donald Trump. It is why a lot of traditional conservatives were distrustful of him in the primaries. He did not win the majority of votes in the primaries. He won the primary because it was a fractured field. The Ted Cruz types, they thought that he was a fake conservative. And if you look back at his history, he's been all over the map.
Yeah. So the way to understand this, you know, we understand this political science. There's this move where businesses routinely start to give money to both parties in order to get local deals. And then there's a larger move where businesses start to give money to conservative and Republican causes for kind of a different political project. So I just understand Trump in this kind of the same way that Josh does, as a way, you know, he's trying to cut deals, he's trying to get stuff done in New York, and New York City is a blue city. New York State's kind of a blue state. He has to pay to play.
Hillary was a senator from New York.
Yes, and Hillary was a senator from New York, right?
Yeah.
So one more question, and then I think we got room for one more question. Josh, I know you're going to have to leave us, and thank you for being on the show. What, given Trump's shifts, like, I can understand why conservatives would be reluctant, but what about, but given his wild shifts, why would the alt-right be attracted to him?
Well, I think that it's because he came out and he said that Mexicans were rapists. I think that he has a history going back to the Central Park Five. You know, he demonized these five black kids who were totally innocent. They went to jail for years before their names were cleared for a rape in the Central Park, raping a white woman. It was a really classic kind of one of the ugliest episodes in New York, and he was all over that. He's expressed what they have wanted someone to express for a very long time. He said that, you know, you're being screwed by foreigners, you're being screwed by Mexicans, people of color are sucking you dry. He's said aloud what previous conservative candidates have used dog whistles to kind of suggest, yeah, without saying aloud. So he's giving voice to what they've long believed. Now, how are they going to react now that he is kind of softening his edges? He's recently said that he likes Obama's approach to immigration. So I think he's kind of trying to get away from building a wall and making Mexico pay for it. I think he's trying to get away from this idea of, like, deportation squads to round up 3% of the population and deport them. And I don't know how they're going to react now. I think they're probably so invested at this point. I think that they're probably going to say to among themselves, he's saying what he needs to be elected, but we know where he really stands. I think they're going to stick with him.
What do you think? Todd, are you back with us?
That is correct.
I can stay a bit longer.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Thank you very, very much. I'm so glad. Well, what we're going to do is we're actually going to take a brief break. And then when we come back, we're going to finish this conversation on the media. On our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. Welcome back. I'm guest host Lester Spence, filling in for Mark Steiner on The Mark Steiner Show. We've been spending the first half hour talking about the alt-right movement and the media dynamics and how that affects Donald Trump's campaign and the American landscape. I'm joined by Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation and writing fellow at The Nation Institute. And I'm also joined by Todd Stephen Burrows, an independent researcher and writer based in Newark, New Jersey. Used to be here, now he's gone to better pastures, I guess. I want to come back to and we're also joined by Asasuan Soupsang, a reporter and social media editor covering politics and pop culture for The Daily Beast. Asasuan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I actually want to come back to the idea that Trump is becoming kind of kinder and gentler. So just this week, he actually made a pitch, or earlier, maybe earlier last week, he just made a pitch to black voters trying to actually get at the black vote. Now, given the alt-right's roots and kind of a white nationalism, some might argue that he's actually attempting to move away from them in order to make himself more palatable to American voters, or to Asawan. Could you actually respond to that?
I mean, a common criticism of Donald Trump's latest so-called outreach to African-American communities is that he's not actually trying to reach African-American communities with those speeches. He's trying to reach, say, white middle-class voters who he thinks he could maybe make them feel better about his supposed bigotry, like to make himself seem more moderate, the white voters he's trying to target. Like, if he were going to give a pitch to black voters, he would speak to black communities and go to black audiences, which we have not seen at all from the Trump campaign. And as for, has Donald Trump been going through a period of softening in the past week or two? I mean, we how many times have we heard this during the Trump campaign, over and over again, that there's been a pivot, there's going to be a reboot, there's going to be a kinder, gentler Donald Trump, and then give it 47 hours, and we're back to the same narrative we've had for the whole thing.
Yeah, minus 46 hours.
46, yeah, maybe 45.
Yeah, like more like two. It's like you, it's the weirdest thing.
He gets his password back to his Twitter account, and then everything goes down.
Now I'm laughing because he's kind of funny, but there actually is something to be said about kind of how this fits in, about the kind of the danger this poses, not just in America, but in a broader European context, or in a broader kind of Western quote unquote context. I want to get back to that, but first we've actually got a caller. Donna, you're on the air with Mark Steiner's show.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
You know, and I'm enjoying your guests, all of you all talking. What is your guest's perspective on that new book that's coming out called Trump Revealed? Because the investigative reporters, they went in depth about his life growing up from a childhood, his relationship with his father, et cetera. That's my first question. And another thing is Trump trying to push the Browning of America fear that white nationalism or the white people are dying off? Because that's been, you know, that was supposed to take place 5 years ago with the Browning of America and whatever. So is he trying to tap on the nerves of those who have that fear, especially white males, of the Browning of America? And then what role does the people of color in this country need to do to push us out of that total insanity, something similar to what Dr. Frances Welsey wanted us to do, to move towards, you know, just not worrying about race, but worrying about the fear of white people and their genetic annihilation? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So there's a lot there. Josh, you're only going to be with us a few more minutes. So what I'd like to do is actually put at least one of those questions to you. What do you think about the kind of the Browning of America idea?
This is an interesting thing. You're actually asking me a question about something that's kind of a pet issue of mine. The Browning of America is a myth. It began with the Census Bureau trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that Hispanic is not an ethnicity, right? There are black and white and Asian Hispanics. Hispanic just means that you can trace your ancestry to a country that speaks Spanish. And so in the 80s, they tried to figure out how to deal with this, and they differentiated between white Hispanics and non-Hispanic whites. And what they ended up doing was creating this thing. If you go to the census projections in 2050, right, everybody thinks, well, this is when we're going to become a majority-minority country. But if you look at the top line, it shows that the all-white population, that is, white people who say, I'm white, who identify as white,
yeah,
but also have some other attributes. They might, you know, identify as white Hispanic or white Asian or white whatever. Mixed people of mixed heritage who think of themselves as whites, who present themselves as whites, they are going to be, I think it's, they're going to decline from something like 78% to 69%. Don't quote the exact numbers, but there's still going to be a healthy majority. So this is something that has been stoked unintentionally by the Census Bureau as it tried to figure out an increasingly complex populace where people have multiple overlapping identities. So they, stories. Oh well, in California, majority of babies are non-white. Well, that's not true. The majority of babies are not people who identify solely as white. But the majority is still people who identify themselves as white and maybe something else. So it's a really fascinating issue. This is a myth that's been embraced by both the right and the left, because the left thinks, soon white people who are terrible in terms of their political, overall, who are terrible politically, are going to be in the minority, and then we're going to have this, liberal utopia. And then the right thinks, well, Jesus, we're dying out. We're going to be a minority group. We're going to be treated like we've always treated minorities. And it's just this incredibly consequential myth.
I think the myth is definitely there. I also think, like you do, that this idea is overrated. I mean, first of all, the 1% of this country, the people who control all the levers of power in the society, will be white. So,
yeah.
I mean, so it doesn't matter if America is 70% people of color and who identify with people of color. The 1% is going to be white. I do think, though, that the myth has gotten a lot of traction during the Obama years, because when you look at this white reactionary movement, I mean, let's think about it. A black president with a Muslim name, with a black American wife, going to the White House, the black president nominates a Latina for the Supreme Court who votes for gay marriage.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
From the white national perspective, a lot is wrong.
Yeah. Oh my God! The world is over.
And see, that's where that kind of myth grand gains traction, because white people are like, "Well, wait a minute, hold it. What happens in my America?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, what happened in my post World War II? The United States controls 50% of the world's manufacturing. What happened to that America?
Yeah. Yeah.
That America now is not even on TV land anymore, right? Even TV land now uses TV shows in the 80s and 90s now, right? So, like, they've lost their cultural moorings.
I don't even think they play Dobie Gillis anymore, and that kind of hurt
right,
me.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Right. I mean, the thing is, when you hear the term the Browning of America in popular culture and media, usually it's coming from people like Ann Coulter, who are obviously using it as, like, a fear-mongering tactic or something to be said derisively. When I hear it, I mean, I know if I hear white nationalists saying it, I know what they mean. But what I think is, okay, America is getting more diverse, media is getting more diverse, people are getting more racially tolerant, the music is getting better, the food is getting better. So, yeah, please, keep browning America. I'm all for it.
So, Josh, I think we're going to have to – I know you've got to get off the phone. I just want to give you a shout-out and tell you thanks so much for your work and holler at us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. We've got a caller on. It's been on for a minute. I apologize. Leo Burrows from Baltimore.
Yes. Good morning, my friends. How are you?
I'm doing fine, brother. How are you?
Well, great. I'm enjoying this show. I'm telling you, it's a lot of fun and it's a lot of knowledge involved here. I'm wondering how you feel about the two-party system as it currently exists, the dictatorial monopoly that exists in this society. And keep in mind that, of course, I personally cannot vote for Donald Trump because I think he's a carnival barker. But he has had a history of being friends with the Clintons. And, of course, I can see that the millennials, some of them, who weren't born when the Clintons were in the White House, might have an attraction to the Clintons. They may not. But I'm 74 years old, and I don't have any attraction to the Clintons at all because they've been there before. So we've got a political, this political dynasty movement in this country, whether it be the Bushes or the Clintons. Yeah. How well is that going to serve the interests of this country when we have a Mr. President, Bill Clinton, and Mrs. President, Hillary Clinton in the White House? Of course, they're going to trade places, but how creative is that when it comes to the Democratic Party's thinking? I'm inclined to vote for the Green Party or some other party when I go to the polls at this point in time. A certain lack of creativity or dynamism here that speaks to the dullness of this whole election and how the cards have been stacked.
So what I'll do in this for this question, thank you so much, Leo, is take kind of my host prerogative as a political scientist. And I'll just say that the two-party system we have is what we have. It can potentially change. We've seen ideological shifts in parties, like the Republican Party today is not the Republican Party of yesterday. The Democratic Party today is not the Democratic Party of yesterday. But two-party institutions are incredibly durable. And it's possible that they can change ideologically. It's going to be very, very difficult to change how they operate vis-a-vis our political institutions at both a national and a state level. So I think that a number of people are making the same type of vote decisions that you're making, Leo. But I think that thinking about it institutionally, these are the parties, to the extent that we're thinking about liberation or freedom for some segment or for all of us, we're going to have to figure out how to kind of work with the parties we have. And this is speaking from someone who doesn't plan to vote for either Clinton or Trump in the presidential campaign. We have another caller I want to get to. Gwendolyn, you're on the air.
Hey. I really enjoyed your show, just like Mr. Leo Burrow in Bowdoin Hill or Bowdoin House or whatever. But anyway, Mr. Leo, we're getting 2-for-1. This is great. Thank you.
You're welcome. I don't think I quite thought about it like that, but I guess that's kind of accurate. I actually want to shift the lens a bit. And move and think not just about the American context, but the West in general. And this is something that I think that Joshua alluded to at the outset. How do we think about the growth of the alt-right as it relates to the Trump candidacy in a larger context, whether it's Brexit in England or, you know, in other instances of similar growth in other countries?
Well, it's funny you should bring up Brexit, because the news just broke a few seconds ago that Nigel Farage is to share the platform with Donald Trump tonight. The news is that he will not endorse him, but he will be there to tell the story of Brexit.
And for our listeners, tell us who Nigel is.
Nigel Farage is a British politician and the biggest backer of Brexit. And as everybody knows who's been listening to what Donald Trump has been saying in the wake of that decision in the UK, Trump has been a big cheerleader for Brexit. So he and Nigel Farage right now are, a natural pairing. But to go back to what you were mentioning earlier about what this means internationally, I'm sure you can make a lot of analogies with regards to the rise of the alt-right and Donald Trump's more, shall we say, if we were to be less generous about his politics, his more far-right fascistic overtones in a lot of his rhetoric. You could certainly make plenty of analogies to European far-right parties and other parties of that nature that have been rising in Western democracies lately. But I'm not sure if Trump himself and the phenomenon of Trumpism necessarily says anything about what could happen in other Western democracies, because quite frankly, that has been happening for a while. If anything, the United States is a little bit late to the far-right party.
Yeah, and actually, in that kind of, as I think about that, that kind of goes back to the two-party issue, the two-party structure here, at least partially, right? So one of the reasons why you have the far-right actually explode in other places is because other places have different party systems that allow for the existence of a third and other party movements to come to the fore and actually have to take some role
exactly.
in government. Yeah.
Yes, in France you have more choices whom you would cast your vote for, but you also have a greater chance of an actual genuine fascist coming to power.
Yeah.
So that's the trade-off, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Todd, what do you think about the idea of – so when I've been talking about the Trump tendency, what I didn't think he had a chance to win. I didn't think the Electoral College would have been hard for any Republican, but definitely Donald Trump. But I didn't think that it was actually about winning the presidency. Again, and this is before I knew about the supposed media play. I thought that it was more about kind of generating a tendency that could actually grow either at the state level or in Congress, if not the Senate. What do you think about that idea?
I think that we're in a period where people want to make a statement. And I think that Trump, like Brexit, is a very clear statement.
How do you think that this will... So the statement comes and he loses. So what happens after that?
Well, there may be, as we know from studying the Civil War, there may be nothing more romantic than a movement that fails, right? A lost cause. The idea that Trump could set up this movement and it fails, and the, you know, the only thing that comes out of it is a major digital, assumingly digital, media institution is not really a failure. I mean, we've been dealing with this lost cause idea for instance, in America for several decades now, and there are white people in the South who just can't accept the fact that they committed treason and they lost and they should have lost. This idea that white nationalism will continue in some form and that they were up against the powers that be might be a very romantic idea for the Trump followers. And it might spur people to continue to push these ideas, which is going to be very disturbing, obviously.
We've got a couple of more callers I want to get to before we go to break. Fred, you're on Mark Steiner's show.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning to you, brother.
You know, I'm trying to figure out, are we to believe that the Democratic Party, the party of Lincoln, became the party of the Democrats? Are we to really believe that?
Oh, that's your question?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're saying that, I hear people saying that, you know, we don't want to go with the Democrats. But are we to believe that really that the Republican Party became the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party became the Republican Party? Should we believe that?
Well, I think ideologically, ideologically, we know that the Republican Party not just picked up at least a couple of Dixiecrats who believed in Jim Crow segregation. They won the Deep South decisively, starting in the mid '60s to now, and those Deep South voters previously voted for the Democratic Party.
But if you look at the conditions of the black community in the South, and look at the conditions of the black community in the metropolitan areas where the Democrats are in charge, I think you'll see there's a great difference in the outcome. I mean, for 60 years, like Trump said, we've been unjustly served by the Democratic Party in the major metropolitan areas. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would agree, but I would actually argue that that's not a function of Democratic Party, not primarily a function of Democratic Party policies. And secondly, I'd argue that the Republican Party has actually shifted farther to the right than the Democratic Party has, and the idea that supporting the Republican Party as it stands now would actually help the black community more, I think, is an idea that doesn't really have data behind it. Nick Crofton, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. And I want to pick up your point because I think Trump's, his argument is absurd, right? I mean, that that there are ills that the political landscape in America has always presented to African Americans, and really not just race, but class in America. We've always, I'm not trying to speak for all Black and African American people, but we've always done the common sense thing, which is to vote for the thing that comes closest to your self-interest,
yeah,
as opposed to many on the right that just vote for something that they perceive as, you know, going to do better as far as shutting down immigrants and shutting down the rights. And some rights they're talking about is like civil rights, which actually benefit them, but they don't look at a strategy that actually benefits them. So Trump's absurd argument that what have you got to lose, and then pointing everything, because I mean, I'm not trying to take up all your time, but we now know that the war on drugs was a war on Black and brown people,
yeah,
to incarcerate, and along with the incarceration and, yeah, the incarceration industrial complex. That's not arguable, right? That we now know that. And here's one of my further, I'll get off after this, but I'm asserting this, and I have enough evidence just in my opinion, you know, I think it's evidence that I think the crack cocaine epidemic was started by the United States government in this country to incarcerate others, for people to make money on. So this assertion that, you know, it's almost like he's making the point that, you know, you helpless people, you know, and I just think that it's absurd. And, you know, the heavy lift on all this is, you need to solve these problems. You need to stop incarcerating people and breaking families up and actually get an economy that works for everyone. So those are my comments. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Oh, thank you very much, Nick. So Todd and Asamoah, we only have a few minutes left. I have a question for you guys, and then you can respond to the comments from the listeners if you'd like to. So imagine a scenario in which so Trump loses, and then he does create some type of media entity that's alt-right geared. And then that media entity exists alongside of Fox, which maybe has to move either to the right to chase the alt-right or become more traditionally conservative. What happens to the political landscape going forward if that were to happen? Todd, I'll take you first, and we'll move to Asamoah.
Very simply, we will be even more stratified. We will even be more tension-filled, and whites will have a space in which to continually riot, which will do nothing but spread more ignorance and confusion and white supremacist dogma.
Asamoah.
If Trump does lose, obviously he and his political followers, who now make up what I guess we would not so affectionately call Trumpism at this point, are not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fascinating to see what happens to the Republican Party in this election's wake, again, assuming if Donald Trump loses, and how it deals with Trump and his followers going forward. I'm not sure I can properly diagnose either way what will happen. Would that split the Republican Party and create a whole different, more white nationalist party? That is an extreme scenario, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or does the Republican establishment do what it can to stamp out this insurgent element? Who knows how successful they'll be at that. What I think will be also interesting is to see if Donald Trump does try to launch something of a far-right media empire with allies like Roger Ailes and Steve Bannon, to see if that will actually be competitive and sustainable. As we've seen Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin try to do something similar, and both, at least in cable TV land, fell flat on their faces. So it will be absolutely fascinating to see what's next for Trump, who now, to the point of his death, will be a political figure and not just some reality TV moron.
Yeah, we're a long way from you're fired. Yeah, again, these two-party institutions, it's not just that they're naturally durable, right? It's that they actually create the rules that enable their continued existence. There's bipartisan support for two parties, right? There's two-party support for two parties. So whatever direction, I think it is unlikely that we see the development of a viable long-term third party in the United States, something that can really, really compete at the national level. But I think what is possible is that you're going to see the equivalent of internecine warfare in the Republican Party. And I think what you're looking at is the potential that the Republican Party moves even further to the right. Now, we know it's going to be difficult for them to win the presidency. It may become difficult for them to hold the Senate. But in as much as right now, I think they have between 30 and 35. They dominate the state legislatures of between 30 and 35 states. And they'll dominate the Congress. I think that we're looking at least one house in the legislature move further and further and further to the right. I think that's.
I mean, well, what's clear is that the Republican Party is not a minority party. I think you're making that point quite well.
Yeah, I think that's I knew we'd have a black president. I knew as soon as I saw Obama speak in 2004 that he'd be the guy. I just got the timeline wrong. I don't think I ever thought I'd see a time when somebody like Donald Trump would be a legitimate presidential candidate. And I don't know if I would have foreseen a moment like the one we're living in politically. There's a Chinese quote, may you live in interesting times, or if it's not a Chinese quote, it's a quote that people attribute to the Chinese. I think we're definitely in interesting times now.
And I remember that quote being attributed to being a curse.
Yes.
Right. And the funny thing is that for liberals and people on the left, this is sort of a moment when they look at the Republican Party and are saying to themselves, as Republican elites are kind of scratching their heads, wondering how the hell did this happen? How did Donald Trump become our nominee? If you are to be a bit unkind to the Republican Party, you can easily throw this back at them and say, the only reason Donald Trump has been so successful in your primary and the reason you're now straddled with him in the general election is because he is just straight up saying and doing what you guys have been dog whistling for decades,
yeah,
since at least the Reagan era. So this sort of does seem aggressively left field just because of the kind of personality Donald Trump is. But in terms of a lot of his rhetoric and policy prescriptions, particularly the anti-immigration stuff, this has been festering for a long time. And the Republican establishment leaders who talk about how much they loathe Donald Trump have been basically egging on people who think like this for a long, long time. So this could be something you could interpret as something, as a candidate the Republican Party deserves in 2016.
Yeah, and that's fair. And actually, let me restate that another way. I'm not surprised that a right-wing candidate comes to the fore of the Republican Party who basically says what they've been alluding to. I'm just surprised that it's actually somebody like Donald Trump who from one day to the other can tell two totally different lies that are publicly verifiable as lies.
And right.
Yeah, on a not happy note, I really, really want to thank both of our guests, Asuwan Soupsang, reporter and social media editor covering politics and pop culture for The Daily Beast, and my man, Dr. Todd Burrows, independent researcher and writer based in Newark, New Jersey. I wish you were in Baltimore. I miss you, brother.